One of the biggest stories, not just in issues of faith and politics and of medical ethics, but in fact, the biggest stories around the world in the past few weeks has been that of Alfie Evans, the poor little boy who very recently died following a dispute between his parents and doctors about whether he should be continued to be supported and kept on a ventilator. And then at one point, they're wanting to take him across to Italy to be cared for there. And there's been this huge fight through the courts questioning what is the best thing for Alfie, what's the best care for him, and who gets to make that decision. It's something which has exercised a lot of Christians as well. It interestingly has led to lots of disagreements amongst Christians about exactly what the right thing to do with this situation was and what the right limits in all these different areas is. And so we were delighted that we got to speak to someone who's a real fantastic expert in this area, the head of the Christian Medical Fellowship, Peter Saunders. Many of you will have read his writing on various issues, including a very good blog article he did recently on this topic, which we'll put in the show notes. And I popped over to their offices the other day to have a chat to him, and here's what he had to say. And I'm here now with Peter Saunders of the Christian Medical Fellowship. Peter, thanks so much for taking the time to chat to us.
Pleasure.
Peter, you've just run across town from a major case, the Conway case, happening today. Can you tell us a little bit about the facts of that case and then the wider significance of it?
Yes, well, Noel Conway is a man from Shropshire in his late 60s who has motor neurone disease. So he's terminally ill and will die in the next few months. And he's wanting to help to kill himself. So he's wanting assisted suicide, which the law doesn't allow. And so he's gone to court. He initially went to the divisional court last year, lost. So he's appealed to the Court of Appeal. And he's arguing that the Suicide Act, which gives us an absolute ban on all assistance with suicide, is incompatible with his human rights under the Human Rights Act, and specifically his right to family and private life, so-called Article 8. And so what he's wanting to get is for the court to declare that the Suicide Act is incompatible with his Article 8 rights and kick the whole thing back to Parliament to put pressure on them to legislate to allow assisted suicide for people like him who are terminally ill, mentally competent, and adults. So there's a wide number of people that we're talking about. And he's proposed a scheme whereby this could work, he thinks. And it involves tests about mental incapacity, making sure there's no coercion, testing all the boxes are ticked, but then finally two doctors and a high court judge make a decision about it. So that's what Conway's all about. The case has been brought on behalf of Conway by Dignity in Dying, the former Voluntary Euthanasia Society, and they're up against the Secretary of State for Justice. Mm. And Care Not Killing, an alliance of which CMF is a part, is intervening formally in the case. And so I'm there because one of my hats is as the campaign director for Care Not Killing, and Not Dead Yet UK Disability Rights Group are also intervening. So it's been the third day of three today. The judgment will come out, I expect, in about 4 to 6 weeks, and it will be very interesting. And either way, it'll go to the Supreme Court. There's no question about that. And then, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. What's fascinating about this case is it's not just about assisted suicide. It's about a much, much bigger issue. And that's the role of the Supreme Court, or the courts in general, versus Parliament, and who has the final say. Now, in other jurisdictions like the US and Canada, the Supreme Court can overturn Parliament. You know, so in Roe versus Wade on abortion, a burger fell on same-sex marriage, the Supreme Court in the US overturned Congress. Now, the UK system is a bit different. The Supreme Court could put pressure and advise and declare incompatibility between an existing law and the Human Rights Act, but it can't actually change the law. It's got to put it back to Parliament. And what makes that so fascinating is that the Secretary of State for Justice have put in their top lawyer, their top barrister, James Edie, to debate this because Parliament see just how crucial this cases, not just about issues of life, but issues about where it is institutionally appropriate to make decisions. So it strikes right at the heart of Britain's constitution, if you like.
And of course, that comes
on the heels of a couple of years ago, a vote in Parliament not to legalise euthanasia, which itself came on the heels of the Supreme Court, I think it was, saying that Parliament had to make clear what the law was in this area, which Parliament then seemed to do.
That's right. In fact, there have been over 10 attempts through various British parliaments to change the law to allow assisted suicide or euthanasia or both over the last 12 years, and every single one of them has failed. And the last one, Maris Bill in 2015, failed spectacularly because the vote was 330 to 118 against, and it was cross-party opposition. So this was something that whether you were right or left of the political spectrum, people felt that it was wrong because of the risk to weak and vulnerable people. And it's precisely for that reason that our opponents have, in a sense, given up on Parliament. And they're now going through other routes. So they're trying, you know, the small islands of Guernsey and so on, or they're going through the courts. And this is just the most recent of many different cases. So we've had Pretty case, we've had Debbie Purdy, we've had Nicholson Lamb, and now we've got Conway.
Now, I wanted to talk to you about one of the not just biggest bioethical stories of recent times, but one of the biggest stories of the past month, which has been Alfie Evans. Before we get into sort of some of the questions and ethical challenges around it, perhaps most usefully to just lay out some of the facts first.
Yes, absolutely tragic case. And everyone's got involved, and it's had the international spotlight on it. So even the Pope has been making declarations about it, and everybody's been virtue signalling one way or the other, so big on social media too. Alfie Evans, who died this week, tragically, was 23 months old, and he was initially admitted to hospital under a year old back in December 2016 after he'd had a series of seizures, convulsions, fits. And they attempted to work out what was happening. They had to put him on a ventilator, and he's been on a ventilator, gradually deteriorating now in what's called a semi-vegetative state ever since, with very, very little, if any, interaction at all. And they don't have a diagnosis in the sense that they don't know for absolute certain what the underlying disease process is, but they know it's a very severe neurodegenerative condition, which has destroyed most of his brain to the extent that he's now, you know, unable even to breathe without ventilatory support. And so that is the tragic circumstance. Now, the debate has been over whether and how long ventilation should go on, and that's where the doctors and the parents of Alfie have been at loggerheads and haven't been able to reach a decision. Now, most cases like this never get to court, because they're resolved through patient discussion, and then everyone eventually is on the same page. But in this case, and in cases where they can't be resolved through discussion, it goes to court. And under British law, under the Children's Act of 1989, the court has to make a declaration in the patient's best interests. And the views of the parents are taken into account, but the parents don't have absolute sovereignty. And so the court can rule if they believe there's harm in a certain course of treatment to a child, to overrule the parents or take a different view from them. Now there are situations where, obviously, if there is deliberate harm or neglect, then it's reasonably clear cut. But in these sort of cases, when there's argument over what harm is being done through having a child on a ventilator, it becomes much more difficult. And this is why this is a case that's divided doctors, and it's divided people in the general public, and divided people all over the world, really. And there are no winners.
Mm. And you say they often don't get to court, these cases. What's the sort of timeline for something like this? Because presumably you can't go straight from diagnosis to, you know, decision to court. To, you know, it takes time.
Yeah, and these cases are often very difficult to diagnose. So semi-vegetative state is not a diagnosis, because it's a condition of the brain, but there's an underlying cause. And in this case, we don't know what the disease process is. But obviously, both diagnosis and prognosis or outlook can be very difficult to assess. And so you give a trial of treatment and see how things go. And some children or adults with brain injury will recover, and some won't. And obviously, the longer this went on and the worse it got and the worse the scans looked, it was pretty clear that this was a progressive terminal condition that was going to result in Alfie's death, and in fact, had ventilation not been used, he would have died some time ago.
Now, you wrote a very helpful blog article outlining some of the sort of issues around this, and you particularly wanted to divide two key issues that you think if you thought about slightly separately.
Yeah, I was reluctant to get into this whole debate because there's been so much acrimony and disagreement, and in a sense, whatever you say, it's a bit like the Liverpool care pathway. You're going to get the wrath of both sides and no one will be happy. But what I did decide to write on it because I wanted to try and diffuse some of the tension that there was and the emotion that there was, and try and clarify the issues, because I think it's very important, especially that Christians really think through these things from first principles. And I said there are two key questions here. The first one is, how should Alfie be treated? And the second one is, who should have the final say? That those are the questions. And so with regard to the first one, I was pointing out that there's a very big difference between, on the one hand, euthanasia, where a doctor deliberately ends the life of a patient with an injection of barbiturate or whatever, on the one hand, and withdrawal of treatment on the other, where you've got to decide whether a treatment is more burdensome than it gives benefit. The burden outweighs the benefit. And doctors make these decisions in every field of medicine every time. You know, will we give all available treatments? Well, no, we won't give these because the treatment's worse than the disease, you know, or the burdens outweigh the benefit. And so that's the question. So deliberately ending a patient's life is always wrong, I would say, from a Christian point of view and from a legal point of view at the moment. But allowing someone to die is sometimes wrong if it's done with an easily treatable condition, we call it negligence, but it's sometimes right and good medicine in a situation where death is imminent, inevitable, we're powerless to stop it, and any remaining treatments, their burden outweighs their benefit. And in that case, it is appropriate to withhold and withdraw treatment. And it certainly is appropriate in some cases of severe brain injury to withdraw or withhold ventilatory treatment. The question is, you know, in this case, where we were at, and I think it's easy to be wise in retrospect, but looking back now, we saw that little Alfie did survive a few days after the ventilation was stopped, but no more than that. So his brain was very, very severely damaged, although he had some brainstem function left, which meant that he died within days rather than within minutes of having the ventilator switched off. So I think where the disagreement lies is, we have to start, I think everyone agrees that this was a desperate case where there's no hope of a cure, there's no hope of improving his condition or even slowing down the progression of it. So it's all about supportive treatment, treating symptoms, distress, pain, that sort of thing, and providing basic care, food and fluids and oxygen. And then the debate is around whether you should continue with ventilation or not, and for how long. And that's where the emotions come to play. And certainly the opinion of his doctors was that it was constituting harm and shouldn't carry on. I guess there is an interesting logical question here, because if on the one hand, Alfie couldn't feel anything and he was completely insensate, if you like, therefore incapable of feeling pain, then what harm would continuing a ventilator actually do, some people might say. But at the same time, it clearly wasn't curing him or helping him either. And so it's a decision where doctors will be divided and where the parents were divided. And the parents had what they wanted to do, recognizing that this was very serious, was that they wanted to continue the ventilation for longer. The hospital weren't prepared to do that. They couldn't send him home on a ventilator under the NHS. And so the only option for them was to go to another country. And so this is why they sought to make him an Italian citizen and fly him to a hospital in Italy where he could continue the ventilation and supportive treatment. In the United States, if it had come down to that, the parents would have been the final arbiters, because there'd been the option of private medicine as well, yeah. You see. But here, because the decision is made on the basis of best interests, that the parents didn't. And I think a lot of the ill feeling and antagonism about the case arose around that point. So on the one hand, the judgment was saying, you know, we're not to continue this treatment, and that's, you know, fair enough. That was a professional judgment. But going a step beyond and saying, and no one else is going to do it either, even if you can pay for it. Yeah. And I think that's what created the interest.
And there were two sort of particular details that are important around the whole best interest in terms of going to Italy, for example. One was around the risks involved for Alfie, yeah, and with the travel. And then this other thing of who makes a decision as well, which you said was the second big question.
That's right. And with the risks, you might say, well, if he's going to die anyway, if you stop the ventilator, then, you know, why is it even an issue to talk about the risks of travel if it's his only hope of living longer? You know, so, but I think when it comes down to the parents, it is a real question, I think, of law and of ethics as to who should have the final say. And I think some people would say that the way the law is set up now, at the moment, with best interests being the determining factor decided by a judge, it does undermine, to some extent, parental authority. So, you know, we would all say, always say that it is appropriate for the courts to intervene in cases of abuse or neglect or harm. But what about where we just feel the parents aren't necessarily doing the best thing, but they're acting in good faith and really believing they're doing the best thing? Should we be intervening in cases like that? And once you start to allow that, then you're in an interesting situation where which could have much wider application in terms of parental decisions.
That's the law we're working with here, isn't it? The Children's Act, which is the bit that is referring to best interests, is in large part...
It's in the Children's Act.
Yeah, it was written in large part for cases of abuse and things like that.
That's right.
But here, of course, it's a very, very different situation it's being applied to.
So 1989, well, you know, we're 30 years on, aren't we? And medical technology's moved on a lot. So, it does raise questions. Although the whole question of best interests, of course, has been picked up in other legislation since, and it's become a major factor in determining withdrawal of treatment decisions for adults as well. So the Tony Bland case in 1992, the Hillsborough victim who had a feeding tube removed in his best interests and died from dehydration effectively. And then, of course, best interests is a major factor in the Mental Capacity Act of 2005, which lays down guidelines for when food and fluids can be withdrawn in cases of brain injury. So, yeah.
And so there are many people around this case who would say that a law that looks more like the American system, where parents get more say, would be preferable. Do you think that's likely? Do you think that's possible in the way that the law could change in the UK?
Well, I can't see the law, given the constitution of Parliament and the amount of water that's gone under the bridge since Tony Bland, I can't see a quick reversal on the whole principle of best interests, because it's so fundamental to British law at the moment. It would need a big parliamentary majority to do it. I can't see any will of Parliament to revisit that. But cases like this do raise the question about whether it's the right criterion. And of course, you have other cases which raise similar questions. There was the case people might remember of Ashia King, a little boy with cancer being treated in Southampton, who the parents didn't want him to have chemotherapy and radiotherapy because they thought there was a treatment called protein beam therapy available in other European countries that was better for him. And you might remember they took him out of the country, and they were arrested and they were put in jail. And then eventually he was allowed to go to Prague. He had the treatment, and 3 years later he's doing fine, free of cancer. So it you know, it raises these questions. And I think you know, of course, that little boy wasn't on a ventilator. The case wasn't hopeless. It was more a debate about what the best treatment was. But it did seem like within the NHS, he wasn't being given an option that he wanted and that seemed to prove in time to be effective. So I think these things do raise questions about the balance of parental and medical rights and where authority should really lie in the final instance in decision making.
And I just want to pick you up on something else you mentioned, a point you're making around the difference between withdrawal of treatment and treating someone to end their life. There's issues around euthanasia, around something, another big story a few years ago is a Liverpool care pathway, how to deal with people who are coming towards the end of their lives but aren't, but and treat them away, which doesn't directly kill them, but which perhaps hastens their end. And having been involved in the euthanasia campaigns of a couple of years ago, I know that many people who are very strongly against, many Christians who are very strongly against euthanasia, are very in favour of options where perhaps with treatment is withdrawn. Sometimes called passive euthanasia, which is quite very different. As sort of Christians thinking about Christian principles around dignity of life, how do we approach those and differentiate between those different issues?
I think the term passive euthanasia is problematic. I never use it. And I think it's a term used by the other side on this debate. And I think that's because it conflates together two different things. One of them is death that follows withdrawal of treatment, where the intention is that the patient dies, and there may be an element of negligence involved as well. And the other is the appropriate withdrawal of treatment at the end of life, when you decide the treatment is worse than the disease, and that's good medicine. So talking about passive euthanasia to include both of those destroys what is a very important distinction. I think as Christians, we've got to start by saying, you know, it's wrong actively to end life. Giving lethal injections to a person to end their life is wrong, and that's why euthanasia is wrong under case law in Britain. And why assisting suicide is still a crime under the Suicide Act in Britain. And that's all based, if you like, on the Christian principle that human beings are made in the image of God, and that therefore only God has the authority to end life, and that we shouldn't actively end life. So the sixth commandment, you shall not kill or you shall not murder, is based on that idea. I think when it comes to withdrawal of treatment, we recognize as Christians that life has a natural end, and that all of us, if Christ's return is delayed, are going to die, and we're going to die of some disease or injury. And there will become, there is, as the good book says, a time to die. So even with the very best of medical and surgical treatment available today, all that doctors can really do is improve life's quality and improve life's length, but they can't stop the fact that all of us are going to die, because we live in a fallen world where this is inevitable. So it then becomes a question of the judgment call about what treatments you use when, and when you ultimately withdraw treatment. So I'd say, whereas actively ending a person's life is always wrong, withdrawing or withholding treatment is sometimes wrong or sometimes right, depending on the clinical situation. So if you as a fit young man came to my surgery with pneumonia and I neglected to give you antibiotics which would cure you, then that would be profoundly negligent. If I was, if I had ulterior motives in that, that would make it even worse. But on the other hand, if you were 98, you had disseminated cancer, you were on your last legs and developed bronchopneumonia as the final, then I'm not going to be sticking needles in you, putting you on a ventilator. I'm going to help you to die as comfortably as you possibly can, but without killing you. And the important distinction, I think the best way of thinking about this and understanding it is to think, well, what does the doctor write on the death certificate? Because if you're dying from withdrawal of treatment, then what's written on the death certificate is the disease that kills you. But if you're dying from euthanasia or assisted suicide, then what kills you is actually a lethal injection, an overdose of barbiturate. That's what, if you're being honest, you should write on the death certificate. So that's the key question. What is the ultimate cause of death? And it was fascinating in the Conway case today, because when the Secretary of State for Justice, represented by James Eady, was arguing, he said that there is in law a bright line distinctive between withdrawal of treatment and euthanasia or assisted suicide. In this, with withdrawal of treatment, the person dies from the underlying disease process. But in euthanasia or assisted suicide, it's an external agent who kills them. And that's an important distinction in law and an important distinction morally as well. And we'd expect it to be in law because our laws originally were transcribed from the good book, weren't they?
And there's one other case which has been, is still rumbling on, we're waiting for the judgment on recently, which has not gathered as many headlines, which is to do with the issue of a permanent vegetative state and minimally conscious states and withdrawal of clinical assisted nutrition, hydration, CANH around that.
Difficult acronym.
Yes. Can you just unpack what that is? Because that, as I say, hasn't really hit the headlines in the same way, but could be very significant.
Yeah. This all dates back to a very famous case involving Tony Bland. Now, Tony Bland was the 95th victim of the Hillsborough disaster, and he suffered a crush injury to his chest, where he had punctured lungs on both sides, They resuscitated him, took him to hospital, but in the process he suffered very severe brain damage and developed what's known as the permanent vegetative state, which meant that he was awake and went through a waking sleeping cycle, but was unaware. And he had a nasogastric tube down his nose into his stomach to feed him with food and fluids. And his parents wanted him to die. They wanted to pull the tube out, but of course they couldn't do that without a court order. And so it went to the courts. It went to the High Court, the Court of Appeal, up to the House of Lords eventually. This was before the Supreme Court existed. And the House of Lords ruled in a very contentious ruling that they could remove the tube, and they did. And he died from dehydration and starvation, effectively, about 3 weeks later. And that led to a whole body of new cases and case law, which was then all put into statutory force through the Mental Capacity Act of 2005. But they were so worried about the Bland decision and the fact that it might open a floodgate or lead to a slippery slope that they created a rule whereby every case of permanent vegetative state had to go to court for a final decision so that doctors and relatives could not make this decision. And so since that time, every case has. And since that time, now we recognize this new entity of MCS, minimally conscious state, where people are awake but only partially aware, so it's the next step back from PVS, if you like, permanent vegetative state. These patients also go to the Court of Protection at the moment. And there have been, one loses count, but I think it's a high double-figure number of cases in the last 20 years almost that have gone this route. Now, this new case involves a judgment that was made last year involving someone who had minimally conscious state, and the judge said cases like this don't need to come to court anymore. Hey, well, you can imagine the reaction to that, and especially when the British Medical Association and the General Medical Council and Royal College of Physicians threw in their weight behind it and said, well, we agree it should be just the doctors and the relatives who make this decision about the best interests of the patient, and we don't need to involve the courts. Well, of course, the official solicitor representing the government then appealed the decision, and it went up to the Supreme Court, and the case was heard at the end of February, flying pretty much below the media radar, so most people won't know about this. And we intervened through Care Not Killing in this case. And the judgment is still awaited, but should come out in the next few weeks or possibly even days. And meantime, we have a whole new set of guidance which has been written by the British Medical Association and the General Medical Council, which is about to come into effect if the judgment isn't overturned. So it's a very important case. And the reason we intervened was because we saw real potential for abuse here, and especially because cases of PVS and MCS, these are not people on ventilators. If you went into a room with someone, it'd be, you'd see that they were awake. In the case of MCS, partially aware as well, being fed with a tube. And no one knows quite how many in this country. It would be a very good subject for a parliamentary question, but people say it could be up to 20,000 people with PVS and MCS in this country. And so it would affect a huge number of people. And at the moment, the court acts as a kind of protector, because you have to go through all the rigmarole of going to court, and the time expense involved with that means that very few cases come through. But if it was just left up to doctors and relatives to decide, then there would be a lot more decisions being made. And our concern is that just the diagnosing and the prognosticating about PVS and MCS, you know, knowing exactly whether people do have the condition and how long they're going to live and what their outlook is and whether there's any chance for improvement, these things are incredibly difficult to assess. And many ordinary doctors will get it wrong, and therefore it should be properly trained specialists who look at it. And we know that some of the cases that go to the Court of Protection already are overturned by the Court of Protection simply because the doctors have got it wrong. So that's why we feel there should be this extra layer of protection there that the court provides. But it's going to be very interesting. And as I say, virtually no one is aware of this case. Been very little coverage in the media at all, and very little recognition of its importance.
Peter, thanks so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to Dr. Peter Saunders, who's the head of the Christian Medical Fellowship, for giving us his thoughts on this case. And do please have a look at what he's written, if you haven't already, on this particular case. He was interviewed on Premier Christian Radio and a number of other media outlets. And these issues, these cases are incredibly complicated. But I think that for many Christians, not for all, but for many Christians, it seems to me that that was the area of biggest concern, that it was very easy to see this case as one where the state was saying, no, you mustn't do that. And the parents were saying, but we want to do that. And there was this tussle. And I think for many Christians, it was a no-brainer. Well, of course, the parents should have the right, as it were, to seek a second opinion. I think that's where Peter landed.
Well, as I chatted about with Peter, this whole sort of legal principle in this context is best interest. What's in the best interest of the child? And the slightly strange thing there is that, as we said, that comes from the Children's Act, and the main context for that was sort of, you know, domestic abuse or physical abuse, and really sort of troubling, difficult, scary situations. It wasn't the thinking in that situation wasn't primarily of, you know, the sort of thing here where Alfie's parents are incredibly worried for his, you know, life. He's in the clutches of death, and they're wanting to try everything to keep him alive and to help him. It's a law written for one circumstance that seems to be applied to an entirely different one here. And certainly, you know, it seems to be a decision on the knife edge. It's not super clear what best interests are. I think you could side either with the parents or with the doctors on whether it's in the best interest to fly him to Italy or not. But it's certainly, I don't think it's a black and white decision. And therefore, I would hope that the sort of the decision would be biased towards the parents in that situation.
It's fascinating to me that this kind of case just goes to show again how complicated ethical debates and medical dilemmas really are. And, you know, huge respect for the doctors and those who are treating this little boy, because it's not as if they went away behind closed doors and schemed to try to prevent good from being done, but that they were asking themselves the same questions that all of us have been asking. What is in the best interest of little Alfie? And you can only imagine and sympathise to the best of your ability with the heartache that his parents must have gone through, must be going through. And it was quite remarkable, really, to see the overwhelming way in which this case touched the minds and the hearts of so many people in society. And I couldn't help but think that it's so sad that we can be so moved by the plight of this little life and suddenly have such respect and value for the dignity of that little life. And yet we are a country where we have the most liberal abortion laws out of anywhere in Europe. It seems again to be just such a fundamental contradiction in our society. And that's really what this case was about. I guess this case was ultimately about what does it mean to have dignity at such a difficult stage, and when your brain functions are no longer functioning at 100%.
Yeah, well, I was chatting to a friend of mine who's a paediatrician on this issue, and he pointed out this. He listened to Peter's interview, and he pointed out there is this real difference in how we treat brain damage to other organ damage. And he said, you know, there's nowhere near the same encouragement to parents to consider withdrawing treatment from a child who has other serious, you know, organ issues compared to brain damage issue. Because I think we could recognize this in our society that when it comes to brain damage or brain issues, we sort of see this distance, this far greater distance. I think we can see that as well in disability, or, you know, someone who has a mental disability or brain damage in that sense, in many ways is more disconnected from society than someone who has to be in a wheelchair or whatever it is. There is this sort of, we treat it very differently. And that then, as you say, goes back to the whole question of human dignity and valuing people. It's so easy, I think, to end up valuing people for their utility, either their sort of economic utility or their social utility. You know, we talk about being a burden on the National Health Service or being a burden on society. And it's, I mean, you know, without wanting to be blasé about the real challenges of looking after people who can't look after themselves, I don't want to understate that. But ultimately, it's so easy to drift into valuing people for what they can do, you know, what they can do what they're able to do, what their social value is. And that's just not at all what the Bible says, because our value is in the fact that we're made in the image of God, not in our abilities. And it's, you know, ultimately it's sick when we value it in any other way, but it is easy, particularly in these sort of situations, to do that.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think that's the other thing, isn't it? That whole question of seeing somebody as a human being with unrivaled dignity and value, independent of their circumstances, that applies and has its impact on so many areas of public policy debate and in fashioning our laws and so on. And I think it's a reminder of the challenges we face at the moment as a society in terms of the human dignity of those who cannot contribute as much as they used to be able to. That applies in the immigration debate. Very often it seems that we say we support economic immigration. What we mean is we support high-skilled immigration because they're the best for our economy. Well, as a Christian, you know, we need to be very careful about that kind of attitude. But then secondly, it applies in the context of an aging population as well, and asking ourselves, well, we have more and more people who fall into that bracket of they're not paying as much taxes. They've already paid lots of taxes. They're not paying as much now. They've retired from work. Illness creeps in, physical decline, and so on. And we need to make sure that our laws give proper value and human dignity to anybody at any stage of their life, independent of their circumstances. And cases such as this one and others, I think, are all reminding us of the pressure that our legislators are under.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And certainly around the public debate in the coming years, as we see the cost of pensions going up, and as we see the cost of healthcare and social care for those at the latter stage of their life going up, as you say, the aging population increases. As that goes up, and as the working age population probably decreases by proportion, I think I'm concerned that it could be very easy for the whole debate to go in that direction of, you know, these people who are older people who are, you know, sponging off the state and, you know, not really doing anything to contribute, and we're all having to pay for them in a way that, you know, they didn't have to pay for their parents and grandparents. So it's certainly something which I think will only become more intense as an issue in the coming years.
Yes,
but definitely. I think we probably we could talk about this till the cows come home. But I'm sure we'll return to similar cases as Peter said. There are a number of other cases going through at the moment, and certainly I know that campaign groups who are in favour of euthanasia are continuing to campaign to bring that before Parliament again and before the court. So we may well be talking about that again before too long. But thanks again, Peter, for coming on the podcast, bringing his experience and his real sort of nuanced understanding of these issues to the table.